Give me a hug.
It's great to be with you again. I always look forward to my time at Believers. I have warm associations, and I want to thank Dan for inviting me and for the elders for entrusting the lectern to me. I was thinking as they were hooking me up about a story I heard with the microphone here, and this told us a true story that this pastor, when he would come into the pulpit, would wave to the balcony where the sound man was. There's a sound man up there, okay. He'd wave. All right. He'd wave to the sound man, and that would be the signal for him to turn on the microphone because he was going to make his way to the pulpit. Well, this particular Sunday, as he was on his way to the pulpit, nature called, and he got diverted, and the sound man had left, and all these strange sounds started coming over the speaker, and people began to figure out what fixture he was at. And the last thing they heard, they knew he was at the lavatory washing his hands, and that he was fixing his bow tie, and he said, "Go get him, Tiger." I've been in embarrassing situations, but never quite that bad. My text this evening is an extended text. It's found in Genesis chapter 26. And the last two verses of that chapter, and all the way through the 46th verses of chapter 27. The title of the message is From Hero to Zero. And the topic pertains to reflections on retirement. How do we think about retirement? And obviously that has relevancy to those of us who are of retired age, but it has relevance to everybody for at least two reasons. I remember seeing a Celtic church from about the 13th century. And what the people stared at on the wall was a skull and crossbones, like you see on a pirate's flag. And under it, it said, "We were where you are, and you will be where we are." That's a sober reminder. So all of us will be there, the Lord willing, unless the Lord tarries, at this age, and we'll face the issue. But by God's grace, we will build on true doctrine, and doctrine and truth is transcendent. That is to say, it's for all time and for all people. And so what I have to say is relevant to everybody, but I'm going to pinpoint a specific need in the church of how do we think about retirement. So let's begin reading with chapter 26 and verse 34. It actually belongs to chapter 27. It is the frame around the story of chapter 27. When Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and also Basemath, daughter of Eglon the Hittite. They were a source of grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Actually, in Hebrew, the source of Greek, I'm reading from TNIV, is mar ruach, which means bitterness of spirit. It just was bitter gall in their spirit that Esau was marrying the Canaanite. When Esau, Isaac was old and his eyes were so weak that he could no longer see, he called for Esau, his oldest son, and said to him, "My son." "Here I am," he answered. Isaac said, "I am now an old man and don't know the day of my death." Well, he sure didn't. It was 80 years later, about. "Now then, get your equipment, your quiver and bow, and go out to the open country to hunt some wild game for me. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may give you my blessing before I die." Now Rebekah was listening as Isaac spoke to his son Esau. When Esau left for the open country to hunt game and bring it back, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "Look, I overheard your father say to your brother Esau, 'Bring me some game and prepare me some tasty food to eat, so that I may give you my blessing in the presence of,'" and I refer to the Lord as I am. That's what God's personal name means. He is the I am. When he revealed himself to Moses, he said, "I am the one who I am," which means I am purely all that I am. He is the God who is sovereign. He is the ultimate reality. The only true reality in the universe is the I am. Everything else is ephemeral and fading away. That's what his name means. And I use it consistently in the theology. Before I die. "Now, my son," verse 8, "now, my son, listen carefully and do what I tell you. Go out to the flock and bring me two choice young goats, so I can prepare some tasty food for your father, just the way he likes it or loves it." It's a very strong word. "Then take it to your father to eat, so that he may give you his blessing before he dies." Jacob said to Rebekah's mother, "But my brother Esau is a hairy man, while I have smooth skin. What if my father touches me? I would appear to be tricking him and would bring down a curse on myself rather than a blessing." His mother said to him, "My son, let the curse fall on me. Just do what I say. Go." She sounds like a Jewish mother to me. "Just do what I say. Go and get them for me." So he went and got them and brought them to his mother, and she prepared some tasty food, just the way his father loved it. Then Rebekah took the best clothes of Esau, her oldest son, which he had in the house, and put them on her younger son, Jacob. She also covered his hands and the smooth part of his neck with the goat skins. Then she handed to her son the tasty food and the bread she had made. Jacob went to his father and said, "My father." "Yes, my son," he answered. "Who is it?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Please sit up and eat some of my game, so that you may give me your blessing." Isaac asked his son, "How did you find it so quickly, my son?" "I am, your God gave me success," he replied. Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Come near so I can touch you, my son, to know whether you really are my son Esau or not." Jacob went close to his father Isaac, who touched him and said, "The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He did not recognize him, for his hands were hairy like those of his brother Esau. So he proceeded to bless him. That means to welcome him into his presence. "Are you really my son Esau?" he asked. "I am," he replied. Then he said, "My son, bring me some of your game to eat, so that I may give you my blessing." Jacob brought it to him, and he ate, and he brought some wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come here, my son, and kiss me." So he went to him and kissed him. When Isaac caught the smell of his clothes, he blessed him and said, "Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you of heaven's dew and of earth's richness, an abundance of grain and new wine. May nations serve you and people bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother bow down to you. May those who curse you be cursed, and those who bless you be blessed." After Isaac finished blessing him, and Jacob had scarcely left his father's presence, his brother Esau came in from hunting. He too prepared some tasty food and brought it to his father. Then he said to him, "My father, please sit up and eat some of my game so that you may give me your blessing." His father Isaac asked him, "Who are you?" "I am your son," he answered, "your firstborn Esau." Isaac trembled violently, said, "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? I ate it just before you came, and I blessed him, and indeed he will be blessed." When Esau heard his father's words, he burst out with a loud and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me too, my father." But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully and took your blessing." Esau said, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob? This is the second time he has taken advantage of me. He took my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing." Then he said, "Haven't you reserved any blessing for me?" Isaac answered, "I have made him lord over you, and have made all his relatives his servants, and I have sustained him with grain and new wine. So what can I possibly do for you, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me too, my father." Then Esau wept aloud. His father Isaac answered him, "Your dwelling will be away from earth's richness, away from the dew of heaven above. You will live by the sword, and you will serve your brother. But when you grow restless, you will throw his yoke from off your neck." Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." When Rebekah was told what her older son Esau had said, she sent for her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Your brother Esau is planning to avenge himself by killing you. Now then, my son, do what I say. Flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran. Stay with him for a while until your brother's fury subsides. When your brother is no longer angry with you and forgets what you did to him, I'll send word for you to come back from there. Why should I lose both of you in one day?" Then Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am disgusted with living because of these Hittite women. If Jacob takes a wife from among the women of this land, from the Hittite women like these, my life will not be worth living." One more verse, actually 28 continues it. I want to jump down to verse 8, that after he learns that Jacob went to Haran, well, reading verse 6. Now Esau learned that Isaac had blessed Jacob, had sent him to Paddan Aram to take a wife from there, and that when he blessed him, he commanded him, "Do not marry a Canaanite woman," and that Jacob had obeyed his father and mother and had gone to Paddan Aram. Esau then realized how displeasing the Canaanite women were to his father, Isaac. So he went to Ishmael and married Mahalat, the sister of Nebaiot, and the daughter of Ishmael, son of Abraham, in addition to the wives he already had. As I said, I'm going to use this text to take a look at retirement. I think for the first time I began on probably just my own reflections on retirement. I think I first began thinking about age when I was 37 years of age. I think that's rather normal. And I was preparing a sermon that I think is on your tape library on Psalm 90, where it tells us to number our days. And after I had prepared the sermon, I decided to count my days to my 70th birthday, and it turned out I had 12,345 days left. I never forgot it. It was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Of course, I was praying I would be able to add days beyond that, and now I'm 77, and I've been adding days beyond that. The next time I began to think about my age is when I turned 50, and I went to the doctor for my annual checkup, and he says, "You know, you are now over the hill." I said, "Well, that was new to me, but okay." What he didn't tell me, it's an accelerating slope. And you're on roller skates beside. In any case, I think probably in my early 60s, for the first time when I got on a bus, a lady got up to give me her seat. I knew I had had it. At 65, I had to really think hard about retirement because at UBC, Regent is affiliated with the University of British Columbia, and they have mandatory retirement at 65. So I had to really think hard about retirement. Should I retire, which is normal, most people do? Should I, in ministry, retire? And it was a temptation, but I didn't yield to it. I kept on going. Now, Regent had a mandatory retirement at 70 years of age. And again, I had to face it. Will I retire or not? And it was a big temptation to retire. But I went to RTS in Orlando, and they suggested I keep on teaching till I'm 75. So I went, taught there till I'm 75, but they decided they're not going to terminate me, and I just signed my contract for 2009 to when I'll be 78 to keep teaching there. Now, there's a difference between me as a professional worker in the church and the normal person who is employed, has his income, and then retires, mandatory retirement, at 65. For me, the connection of my employment with the Lord's work is coextensive. They are correlated tightly together. But for most people, that's not the case. For most people, there is a retirement when you're 65 or 70. And what happens is we retire also from the Lord's work. Until we reach retirement age, it's not a problem, because our work is being done to the Lord. Whatever we do it heartily as to the Lord. But what happens when you no longer have employment? You're no longer working, and you can no longer say it's for the Lord. And meanwhile, the philosophy of the world is to retire. And all too often, we are tempted to also retire from the Lord's work. We buy into the world's philosophy that you've had your nose to the grindstone all your life. Now is the time to enjoy yourself. Well, it's not right to have your nose to the grindstone. I think that people who have to work 7 days a week ought to ask themselves if they can't take off a day to worship God and do acts of charity. Who is your God? Why do you have to work on a day when you could meet with the Lord's people? And I'm also not too inclined that we're going to have church early in the morning so I can do this in the afternoon, or we'll have church on Sunday night or Saturday night, because what we're doing, it seems to me, we are making the agenda of worshiping God fit our schedule instead of our submitting ourselves to His schedule to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ on the first day of the week. I throw that out as a suggestion that I don't want God to accommodate me. I want to accommodate God and remember Him on the Lord's day, as John put it. In any case, we take the godless that philosophy, don't keep your nose to the grindstone, and certainly it is wrong to have your nose to the grindstone all your life. Because I'm saying you probably have a wrong God, and I am a workaholic, and I know what I'm talking about when I say that. Or we'll say you deserve it. That's what you hear on TV. You've earned it. You deserve a life of ease. And we look at the ads on TV, and we see you should save up for your retirement. And what do? You go on cruises, and you play all the time, and you play in golf, and maybe sitting out on a porch drinking a martini or a mint julep or who knows what. And it's a life of indulgence. that is being advocated. Now, the truth is, for many, that's not the case. I remember seeing the cartoon of an old guy all punchy and looking very sickly, and he was sitting in the doctor's office, and he's very disconcerted, and he's looking at the doctor, and the doctor says, "Remember how you worked so hard to keep yourself alive an extra 20 years? Well, this is them." Get the point. But in any case, we are tempted to retire from the Lord's work and to indulge ourselves, to spend our time on the golf course, to go on a cruise where they burn 6 gallons of oil to go 1 foot on these big ships. It's crazy. But that's what we're inclined to do because we're retired. But that's not what I read in the Bible. I don't read of retirement from the Lord's work at any age. I think of 1 Corinthians 15:58, "Therefore, brothers and sisters, be firm and unmovable, and always give yourself fully to the work of the Lord, and your labor will not be in vain." Always, fully to the work of the Lord. That's the blessed life. And I think that we are caught up in a worldly way of thinking. Now, for me, what happened was, when I was 65, I was beginning to write the commentary on Genesis. And it wasn't 1 Corinthians 15:58 that kept me from retiring. Of course, with me, I'm exceptional because my profession and the Lord's work go together all the time. It was the sobering life of Isaac. That is, he went from a hero to zero. He went from a conqueror to conquered. From triumph to tragedy. From a victorious life to a vanquished life. And it occurred at about the age of 80 to 100 in his retirement years, if that's legitimate to say. But it's about my age that he failed. So it's worth a while to take a look at how he failed and why he failed. So let me give the big picture here to locate Isaac within the whole program of redemptive history. In this Old Testament theology that I just finished, came out in October of 2007, I am looking for, what is the Bible all about? Can you summarize it in one thesis statement? And I think basically what the Bible is about is the inbreaking of the kingdom of God, the breaking in of the world, of the rule of God. After looking at all the data, I realized that the Lord's Prayer summarizes the whole thing. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It's interesting to compare Matthew and Luke. Luke has simply, your kingdom come. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Give us this day our daily bread. And I think Matthew wants to explain what your kingdom comes means. And Matthew adds, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. The Bible is all about the inbreaking, the eruption, I-R-R-U-P-T-O-N, the breaking in from without. It's all about the breaking in of the rule of God. And in the Old Testament, it's all about this nation that's going to establish the kingdom of God. As you work with Genesis, you realize, well, as you work with this concept, you realize that a nation has four factors to it. There's people, obviously. There's land. They have to have space where they exist and life and protection. There's a law by which they're governed. And there's usually a ruler, a king. Genesis is all about the seed, the people, the identification of the people of God who will establish this kingdom. That's what Genesis is all about. It's not only defining who are the people of God, it's also defining the land where they will exist. It's the sworn land of Canaan that is being given to Abraham. That's their place. The law, for that, we have to move over into Exodus and Leviticus. And we get a lot of rulings and numbers and Deuteronomy. That's the Pentateuch. That is the law that governs the people of God. And Joshua, through Kings, is all about the rule. Who will be the ruler of the people of God? Those are the four great themes, and if you get that, you're on your road in the Old Testament. What I'm saying is that Genesis is primarily about defining the people of God. Who are they? Now, the way you, reading literature, the way you establish what is a book about, you look for a key word that's running through the book. And a key word that runs through Genesis is seed. That's the key word. And if anybody knows the book, you know you got the seed, the seed of the woman, the seed of the serpent, and so forth. The other is a refrain that runs through it. And what runs through the book of Genesis is the refrain, these are the descendants of, or this is the account of, and it goes two ways in translation, I'll explain why. The Hebrew word is toledot, that's translated either descendants of, or line of, or account of. Toledot comes from the Greek, the Hebrew root, yalad. The T on the beginning makes it into a noun. The root is YLD, which means to give birth or to beget. It refers to both the male component and to the female component, but it means to give birth. And you have 10 of these, and you're getting this lineage, and it's defining who are, where are the roots of the people of God. So you begin. This is the Genesis 2:4. This is the toledot. Descendants, and who? How do you explain Adam and Eve? Well, they came from the earth. They came from heaven. So they're the descendants of heaven and earth. That's how it starts out. Next one, Genesis 5:1. This is the toledot of Adam. It's not about Adam any more than the first one was about the heavens and the earth. The first one, these are the descendants of the heaven and earth. It's all about Adam and Eve and their immediate family. Next one, these are the descendants of Adam. And it runs through the 10 generations till you get to Noah. Next one, this is the descendant of Noah. And we have his three sons. That needs more explanation, but for our purposes, that's sufficient. Genesis 10:1. This is the account of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and you get their sons. You get to the Genesis 11, middle of the chapter, Genesis 11. This is the toledot of Shem, and you trace it from Shem on down to Terah. Then you get, this is the toledot of Terah. Now, we don't know anything about Terah. It's not about Terah. It's about Abraham. Because he is the descendant of Terah. And now we have a long story about Abraham, but it's in the toledot of Terah. Then we finish that, chapter 25, we get, this is the toledot of Ishmael, and then we get all his descendants. Then in 25:19 we get, this is the toledot of Isaac. But it's not about Isaac. It's about Jacob and Esau. Genesis 36, this is the Toledot of Esau. And then you get all the descendants of Esau. Genesis 37, 1, this is the Toledot of Jacob. And it's all about Joseph and Judah and the 12 sons in the family. So the Toledot is about the descendants. And it is defining, it's going to be the descendant of Adam through Noah. It's going to come through Shem. It's going to come through this one son of Terah, Abraham. It's going to come from him. Ishmael is discounted. And then we get Isaac. It's going to be either Jacob or Esau. And we find out it's going to be Jacob. Then we get Ishmael. He's discounted. And then we get Jacob. And who's it going to be? Well, it turns out it's going to be Judah. He's going to rule over his brothers. That's the climactic moment of that account. But did you notice something's wrong? There is no Toledot of Abraham, which would be the account of Isaac. None. It is, in literature, we make a distinction between an inconsequential omission. We call that a blank. As, for example, Genesis 22:1, we ask the question, well, what was Isaac thinking? What was Isaac thinking when Jacob was offering him up on that altar? Well, we don't know. It's a blank because it's concerning. It was testing of Abraham and not testing of Isaac. So he doesn't discuss it. That's a blank. But when you're dealing with the chosen line, which is what it's all about, and then you get a blank on Isaac, something's wrong. And what's happening in these Toledot, where you get these long stories about Noah and Abraham and Jacob and Joseph and Judah, these stories are telling us this is culturally formative stories. These are stories that help the people of God to understand themselves. So you have this long account of Abraham so that we understand we are people of faith who believe in the impossible. We believe in a God who will bring life out of death, who will bring birth where it is impossible. That's what Abraham teaches us. And we come to Jacob. He goes from zero to hero. Because, and here I gave a whole sermon not too long ago, I think, last year maybe, on Jacob. And he persevered, and in the beginning of his life, he was without prayer, but in the climactic moment when he wrestles with the angel, he doesn't quit. And he, in broken hip and no longer able to wrestle, he just clings to God and says, blesses me. And that's what we are to learn, that we prevail with God and people through prayer. But Isaac has nothing to teach us. Something's radically wrong here. You see what I'm driving at? There's no account. There's no story that is illustrative for us. What's wrong with him is the question. Now, when you think about writing a biography, as I'm going to try to do, is preach a sermon, preach a biography. When you write a biography, you have to think about what is the defining trait of that individual. There has to be a dominant trait. If I say to you, Scrooge, what do you think of? Stingy, right? If I say to you, Sherlock Holmes, you think alert. Observant, brilliant. If you read Don Quixote, as a child, and I say Don Quixote, you think about an intelligent, mad romantic. If I say Abraham, what do you think about? Faith. If I say to you Jacob, what do you think about? Trickery, to get ahead. Very defined traits. If I say to you, Isaac, what do you think of? Kind of blank. And before I really gave hard thought to this, I would have said passive. But that's much too sanguine. It's far worse than that. Now, the best biography that we have is that by Alexander White. And he's written a biography in almost all the biblical characters. That's just superb. Now, I think he overstates the case. But this careful student of biography writes this about Isaac. The patriarch Isaac presents a pale appearance as he stands planted between two so stately and so impressive personages as his father Abraham on the one hand and his son Jacob on the other hand. And indeed, it is forced upon us that it would have been for Isaac and for all connected with Isaac that Abraham's uplifted hand had not been arrested by the angel of the Lord. That's hard language. I'm not going that far, but I think he's closer to the truth than what I was when I said simply passive. There's something far more black here. And the problem is, at the age of our age of retirement, the crucial word now is sensual. He became sensual, self-indulging, to live in his comfort zone. That's why he fails. And he fails in his retirement, or at least the age of retirement. This is a very sobering account that I'm setting before you this evening to think about and ask, what does God have for us here to meditate on? Furthermore, when you're working with biography, you look for not only the defining trait, you look for the defining moment when that trait is exemplified. And for Abraham, the defining moment is when he offers up Isaac and he binds him on the altar, and he's willing to kill his only son in the sense that he is the heir of all the promises, and he's willing to kill him, counting on God to do the impossible, however it's going to be. That's his defining moment. The defining moment of Jacob is when he wrestles with that angel, and he is broken, and he doesn't quit, and he hangs on to God in prayer. And now his name means he will prevail with God and with people. That's the defining moment. The defining moment for Isaac is this story, when he wants to pass on the blessing and he wants to give it to Esau and not to Jacob. This is radically, radically wrong, as we shall see, and we'll reflect upon it. Now, I want to see his whole life. But how do I do it? Because I have no account of Isaac as such. I have the Toledot of Isaac, which is about Jacob and Esau, but no Toledot of Abraham, which should be about Isaac. So what do I do? Well, I've got to patch my material together from the account of Tirach, the Toledot of Tirach, which is about Abraham. And then I have to look at this Toledot of Isaac, which is about Jacob and Esau. As you can see in this story, it's about Jacob and Esau and his passing on the blessing to them. Now, when I look at the account of Abraham, I discover this is the most unlikely person to fail at about 80 years of age. If there's ever a miraculous birth, it is Isaac's. That's what Abraham and Sarah's whole life was about. The very beginning of it tells us that Sarah was barren. She could have no children. And the story goes on. Almost, we're in pain with them. Where is the child? And he cries out, are you going to give me Eliezer? Where's the son you promised me? And you have Sarah, and she says, well, try Hagar and do it in our own way. I think she probably had reached menopause and had given up hope at that point. It's all about that. And finally, his name means laughter, first of unbelief and then of sheer joy that God had kept his promise and they had a child. He is the person of laughter and joy. You would not expect Isaac to fail. Furthermore, as he's growing up, he has the finest theological education that was available to anyone at that time. He grew up in the home of Abraham, the sterling patriarch, the taproot of the whole people of God, the nation of God. It goes right back to Abraham, and so do you, by the way, as you're well aware, because if you've been baptized into Christ, then you are Abraham's seed. We are Abraham's descendants because we share his faith, Galatians 3:29. So it all goes back to him. And Abraham, we're told, God's when he's going to destroy Sodom, he says of Abraham, I've chosen him, chosen Abraham, so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of I am by doing what is right and just, so that I am will bring about for Abraham what he has promised him. Genesis 18:19. So he is carefully instructed in the things of God by his godly father, Abraham. When he reaches about 20, we learn that throughout his life, he had the habit of obedience. This is in the binding of Isaac's story. He had a trust in his father's love and care and trust that God will provide. I mean, he had to be in his late teens because he carried all the wood up the mountain for his own sacrifice. That's not a little kid. That's a strong young man carrying that wood up the mountain. And he's totally obedient to his father as far as we read it. And also, he's trusting God, obviously. Says Deeth in his biography, we scarcely know which to admire more, the brave spirit of the patriarch or the meek resignation of the youth. The son exceeds in humble endurance. Total triumph. At 40 years of age, he marries. If there's ever a marriage made in heaven, it is his. For we realize that Abraham wanted him to have a woman from Paddan Aram. The reason he wants that is that the woman in that culture would embrace the religion of their husbands, whereas the Canaanite woman, they would not submit. You had to submit to their religion, and they would seduce you away. That's why they're so concerned that they marry someone from that culture where the wife is not going to be the leader, but she will follow the spiritual leadership of the husband. And we're told that Eliezer prayed, I am God of my master Abraham. Give me success today and show kindness to my master Abraham. See how I'm standing, he says, as he arrives at the place where he's to secure the bride. I am standing beside the spring, and the daughters of the townspeople are coming out to draw water. May it be that when I say to a girl, please let down your jar that I may have a drink, and she says, drink, and now here's the catcher, and I'll water your camels too. And as I said, the camels drink 25 gallons of water, and they've just come a long trek across the desert, and there are 10 of them. That's 250 gallons of water. That's going to be quite a bride that she's going to give me and the camels too. Let her be the one you have chosen for your servant Isaac. By this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master. Before he had finished praying, Rebekah came out with her jar on her shoulder. She was the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, who was the wife of Abraham's brother, Nahor. God miraculously answers the prayer, a marriage made in heaven. And then we read that when she came from Paddan Aram on the camel, Isaac was in the field, happened to be in the field. He looked up and she looked and their eyes met in providence. And it's a way of saying God arranged this marriage. 40 years of age, he marries. And it's a marriage made in heaven. And he fails. At 60 years of age, well, at 40, they have no children. For 20 years, unlike Jacob, he prays for his barren wife who had no children. 20 years he prays for her. And then, at 60 years of age, the twins are born. Chapter 26, the story of the digging up at the wells and the finding of the water and the Abimelech making peace with him is to show he had all the blessings of Abraham on him. In fact, it is so similar to the blessings of Abraham that those who don't believe in the JEDP hypothesis and all that, they say it's the same event of the same event, but now in the legends attributed to the two different, to the Abraham and to Isaac. That misses the whole point. The point is, he is equal to Abraham. That's not the problem. Isn't the lack of blessing. The problem will be Isaac himself. So the question arises, what went wrong in this story? Now, we get a foreshadow of what went wrong. It's typical literary style. And the passing on of the birthright story. And we're told in chapter 25 and verse 28 that we're told, 27, the boys grew up. We don't know exactly their age. And Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was complete person, stayed at home among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau. But Rebekah loved Jacob. You see, before this defining moment, it's not something all that sudden. Already we get a foretaste that when the boys grew up, he identifies with Esau. Why? He likes his soup. He likes the way it tastes. This is a man who can hunt. This is a man who can make a tasty food, such as I love. And we get the foretaste. This is the little fox that will spoil the vine of his life. And he will go from being triumphant to a tragic figure on the pages of the Bible. It starts right there. Says Rawlinson, the father admires his son's activity and daring, is pleased by his attention, but, quote, loves him because he did eat of his venison, King James, end of quote, giving evidence thereby of a spirit which lapped in a life of ease, not of a gross kind, indeed. No. A life of ease had become in a certain measure tainted with sensuality, not of a gross kind indeed, but still such to seriously weaken his character and to place on a lower level of spiritual development than either his father Abraham or his son Jacob. Lapped in a life of ease, eating tasty game, and misses out in his second half of the closing years of his life. I'm saying this is what sobered me. Now, when you come to our story, there is a frame in chapter 26 that tells you Isaac knows there's something wrong with the boy spiritually. See what it says? When Esau was 40 years of age, he has no faith. He married Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and also Basemath, daughter of Elon the Hittite. They were a source of bitter grief to Isaac and to Rebekah. His heart, his spirit, knew the boy wasn't right. But he loved his soup and got all twisted up over it. And you get it again at the end of the chapter. We're told in 46, then Rebekah said to Isaac, I am disgusted with living because of these Hittite women, which we're just told Esau had married. If Jacob takes a wife from among the women of this land, from Hittite women like these, my life will not be worth living. The same way we feel when the children don't embrace the faith. What's it been all about? We invested in them. And they've just walked away from it all. And they marry into the world. She says, it's been wasted. I'm not going to let that happen. And then Esau finally wakes up. Well, my father's not too happy with this. I'll just buy some, get some other wives, but not from Paddan Aram. So we read in verse 8, then Esau then realized how displeasing the Canaanites' women were. He has no spiritual taste whatsoever. He doesn't see anything wrong with it. It's because of his relationship with his father. He doesn't want to hate his father. Oh, you don't like the Hittite women? Okay, well, I'll marry the Ishmaelite women. But they're not of faith either. That's the frame. But now, within the story, we have these four scenes. We have the first scene, chapters, verses 1-4, all of which teaches something. We have the scene of Isaac and Esau. And then in verse 5 through verse 17, we have the scene of Rebekah and Jacob. And then in verse 18, we have the scene of Isaac and Jacob. And finally, in verse 30, the scene of Isaac and Esau. In the scene of Isaac and Esau, we get the motive. He likes the tasty soup. But to understand that, we need this background that we've been talking about. It was the background of, in that birthright scene, which I don't have time to develop, when he sells his birthright. And the birthright did include a double portion of material good, but above all, the birthright made you the head of this family that was destined to bless the earth. God said to Abraham, your seed is going to bring salvation. And the birthright would have gone to Esau, and he would have been the head of the people of God. And at the end of chapter 25, it says he despised it. It had no use to him. What good is a birthright when I'm about to die? More important than this faith business is to have a roof over your head, clothing on your back, and food in your belly. Now, that's what counts. That's how the world thinks, and that's how he thought. But Jacob, tricked that he was, and not the right way of doing things, he wanted it. He valued it. In my mind, I picture these boys as twins. They're 15 years of age when Abraham dies. They're born when Abraham's 160, he dies at 175. So undoubtedly, Abraham put them on his knees, and he would have told them, we are the people of God. You see, the stars, our offsprings are going to be like that. You see, this land, we're going to have it. This is our land. And beside that, we're going to bless the earth. We're the kingdom of God. Esau didn't believe a word of that. We're going to have great offspring. It's just the two of us. Great offspring this is. We're going to have this land. We don't own a thing. Oh, yeah, we own a cemetery that Grandpa bought for 400 shekels of silver so he could bury her. God gave us nothing. We're going to bless the earth? You must be kidding. I know I can't do that, and my twin brother is worse than I am. So it's all an old man's pipe dream so far as he's concerned. But Jacob believed it. All his faults, he had faith. And you can see it. Because Esau marries outside. He's not concerned about who he marries. He leaves the land. He finds himself in impregnable mountains that was never conquered until David conquered Edom. He leaves the land, marries outside of the faith. Jacob marries in the faith, stays in the land. You could see the difference. One is the faith. And the blessing. The blessing, we're told what it's all about. It's that you're going to rule. Look at, again at verse 28 of our chapter 20, verse 9. May nations serve you. Peoples bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother, which would be Isaac, the man of faith, bow down to you. May those who curse you be cursed, and those who bless you be blessed. The Abrahamic blessing. He wants to give it to the guy who can hunt and make soup. with no faith. This is tragedy of the first magnitude on the pages of Scripture. Is it any wonder that his life is blank? This is not exemplary. If anything, it's bad example for the people of God. The word game occurs 8 times. Tasty food, 6 times. You can tell what a story is about by the repetitive words. And then he loves it in every scene, almost every scene. He loves the tasty food. Get the tasty food. I love. Rebecca says, I'll prepare the tasty food just the way he loves it. You see, it's all sensual. That's the danger I see in retirement. Then I'm going to go on cruises, play golf, live, eat, drink, and be merry. And this story stopped me in my tracks. Then I come to the next scene, and I learn from that too. Because he is sensual, he has to do things secretly, and he's dividing the family. Do you notice how it begins? In verse 5, now Rebekah was listening to Isaac, spoke to his son Esau. When Esau left for the open country to hunt game and bring it back, Rebekah said to her son, Jacob. This is a dysfunctional family. It's mother against father. The mother identifies with the child of son of faith. The father identifies with the man's man, the hunter, the man of the field. As I said, I remember in the Jenny Hoffman School, I preached on Esau one time over there, and I talked about he was the camel's man in the Marlboro country. Those were the days when you smoked and they had all the ads. So that shows how far back that story goes. But he was a man's man. That's why he loves him. And it's ripping this family apart. And he has to do it secretly. The blessing is never done secretly. That was an open, like, reading of the will after death, but it's done before death. Look at Isaiah, look at Genesis 49. What does Jacob say? Come, my sons, listen to me. Let me tell you what will be. And it's a blessing that follows. It's an open assembly. Everybody's there to hear it. When Moses blesses the nation, Deuteronomy 33, everybody's to hear what's going to happen to everybody else. But when you're sensual, you don't want your life to be exposed. You don't want anybody to look at it too closely. And that's what he's doing. He's covering it over. May I suggest, and this is radical, if you want to know whether you're sensual or not, is your income tax an open book, as the president's has to be? Is your checkbook an open book? That would tell us a lot. We're more ready to talk about our sex habits than we are about our money habits, I think. If you're like, well, I'm not willing to talk about either. Anyway, okay, never mind a bad illustration. But you got the point that I'm making. It has to be done secretly. It can't be open. And something's wrong when your life is not an open book so that everybody, so you're vulnerable. It may suggest, this is a hard sermon, isn't it? It's a sobering sermon. But I think I'm true to Scripture. The third scene is the scene between Isaac and Jacob. And what I want you to notice here, you notice what's guiding Isaac? His senses. He's sensual. He touches him. He has to feel him. Now, I can't imagine Esau being this hairy that you can't tell the difference between a son and a goat, but I mean, that's an incredible story to me. But at any rate, he's touching him. And he's blind. Symbolically, he's blind. He can't see what he's doing. He's groping, feeling. And then, and he should have gone by his ear. And there's something to be said there, because the people of God are people of the ear, not of the eye. Rarely do people of God see God, but they hear God. And I hope you might be hearing God through his word tonight. We hear it. We're people of the ear, not of the eye. But he didn't go by his ear. He went by his feeling. And then he goes by his nose. No one said this better than Kidner at this point. All five senses play a conspicuous part, largely by their fallibility, in this classic attempt to handle spiritual responsibilities by the light of nature. Ironically, even the sense of taste on which Isaac prided himself gave him the wrong answer. The real scandal in Isaac's frivolity, his palate had long since governed his heart, because his heart knows it's wrong, and it's not going by his heart and his conscience and his spirit. The real scandal is Isaac's frivolity. His palate has long since governed his heart and silenced his tongue, for he was powerless to rebuke the sin that was his own downfall. He now proposed to make his palate his arbiter between peoples and nations, 27:29. On fitness for office shows in every act of the sightless man, rejecting the evidence of his ears for that of the hands, following the promptings of his palate rather than his spirit, and seeking inspiration through, of all things, his nose. It smelled great. So he blurts out the blessing. He can't restrain himself. Sensual. Secretive. Motivated by material things. He had become like Esau. The last scene is with Esau. And here is an amazing thing. He is a man of faith. He made that blessing in faith that God would do it, and it cannot be revoked. You know, Hebrews says, by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau. He had it all wrong. He had the wrong people. He's blessing the wrong son. And the blessing he gives to Esau ends up to be an anti-blessing. He's got it all mixed up. But he did it in faith. And that's all the New Testament remembers about him. That's all you have. No censor in the New Testament. He had faith. And that's all God remembers. It's absolutely astounding grace to me. And I can identify with that, and you can too, I think, if you've been involved in the Lord's work at all. I know I can preach out of the wrong motives. I can witness out of wrong motives. I can do it all wrong. But nevertheless, I will do it in faith in spite of my mixed up person. And God will bless it in spite of me, because we do it in faith. And that's the grace of God. Let me conclude with three kinds of people that I see facing retirement. First of all, there is the person that Jesus calls the fool. He told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grains and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat. Drink. Be merry. But God said to him, you fool, what the world commends. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? Well, I can answer that. The government. This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God. That's one way of ending it. A fool. Storing it up. And just enjoying it. Then there is the finisher. And that is our Lord Jesus Christ. He said on the cross, "It is finished." He saw it through to the end. His whole life was living in that moment for his death. My hour is not yet come. My hour is not yet come until the Greeks came. And now the hour was come because he had to make atonement for the sins of the world. And he said, "Now my hour is come." This is his moment of glory, to give his life that others may have eternal life. And our last words are, "It is finished." And this is Paul. "As for you, Timothy, always be sober, endure suffering, do the work of an evangelist, carry out your ministry fully. As for me, I am already being poured out as a libation." He's about to die. "And the time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. From now on, there is reserved for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing." The finisher. And thirdly, there's the forgiven. God's grace is always available. We may have lived indulgently. We have failed. But God's grace is greater than all our sins. And as I see in the New Testament, God only remembers the faith. But he goes down on the pages of Scripture. There is historical guilt here. That if we waste it, there is historical guilt. If you kill somebody, God can forgive you, but that person's dead. And if you live this way, there is the historical reality of division, of lack of the Lord's rewards that will come to us. But there is forgiveness. And his mercies are new to us every morning. And tomorrow is a new day of God's grace. This is the first sermon on how this all works out in your life. But what I'm saying, brothers and sisters, always give yourself fully to the Lord's work, for your labor is not in vain. It was after he preached that text that Isaac Watts wrote, "Am I a Soldier of the Cross?" And what I want us to do is stand and sing in conclusion, page 457, "Am I a Soldier of the Cross?"